Okay, we're going to call the Energy Utilities and Telecommunications Committee meeting to order. Thank you very much, everybody, for coming and for your patience. Transportation had went through three bills and got all three bills done, so they held on to the room a little bit longer than expected, but so I appreciate your patience on that. Today we're working on the Renewable Development Fund Reform bill that, as you recall, last year we basically are responding to the Office of the OLA's report, the auditor's report, on how that fund is run and moving forward. So we basically kept the REPI payments, solar rebate payments, intact, but we froze the PUC process going forward until we had a chance to review how this fund is running and the projects that are going forward and see what we need to do to make the whole process better and a little more accountable. We also, in the end, allowed the University of Minnesota their $5 million for 2011, but froze 2012. So those are the major changes. We kept REPI, the solar rebate, 1 year of the U of M, but froze the PUC process going forward. Senator Hayden, that's for you.
I appreciate that. That's what I needed.
It's from the entire committee. It's an energy drink.
I needed that. Thank you. I was just thinking about this. Yeah. This is my sleepy time.
And they're great energy drinks. You won't be bouncing off the table. You'll be just fine. So with that, we were hoping to get a little more feedback through the Legislative Energy Commission or Electric the LEC this past fall, but we basically ran out of time, and so we've engaged. We've had some stakeholder meetings. We've worked with the department on this, and what we've come up with, I think, is a fairly decent bill that addresses everything that the OLA said was a concern. So some of the major recommendations that were proposed by the auditor was, number one, to clarify the purpose and power of the board that advises. Number two, to adopt a single process with clear criteria. Number three, to post status of the individual projects and the account finances on the public website. And number four, the provide for administrative costs. So in front of you, you have just a draft form. As I said, this is for discussion only. This is has not been jacketed. So I'd like to engage everybody in a very good discussion going forward about this. And basically, I just want to frame this up a little bit more, if we could. Under the current law, the purpose of the fund is insufficiently defined. Okay, that's what it says. The funds in the account may be expended, quote, the funds in the account may be expended only for the development of renewable energy sources. So this proposal is going to greatly expand but limits the purpose for what the money can be spent on, and no one is precluded from applying for these funds. That's what this new language says. We do not want to exclude any technology, nor do we want to name any specific technologies in this bill draft. Our only request is that expenditures from this fund must be used for electric energy sources. So I hope that gives everybody out here a little comfort language. So one of the auditor's main concerns was the multi-expenditure process. Right now we have the competitive bidding process, which the auditor felt would work the best. And we had the legislature appropriating money for a variety of projects, much of which had nothing to do with electricity. So this is addressed too. We had a blanket appropriations to the U of M for IRE. We had the REPI payments transferred from the general fund to the RDF fund, and we have a Minnesota-made solar rebate program. So our proposal, the student draft language, streamlines all these expenditures, minus the REPI, through one competitive bidding process, which we all believe here. I strongly believe competition is the best way to ensure that the money is spent properly with the highest rate of return and investment for Minnesota and for the XL ratepayers. Back in 2001, and these comments are geared towards the advisory group. In 2001, the PUC created the advisory board through an order because the law was silent on the makeup of the board. So while the auditor's report was comfortable with the RDF board, and the process they used for project selection, this proposal eliminates any reference to a board and replaces it with an advisory group that must include, among others, ratepayers. We do give the commission the authority to appoint other interests to the advisory group if they feel it is necessary. So basically, really, the makeup of the advisory group could stay the same if the utility feels it deems so. The public utilities role, that is where the advisory group shall consult with the utility in selecting the projects, but the utility has full and sole authority to determine which expenditures shall be submitted to the PUC for approval. And this also, the bill also addresses the third-party expert. The utility must utilize a third-party expert to evaluate proposals submitted in response to request for proposal. And it's under my understanding that the utility already utilizes a third-party expert, I think it's called Princeton Group, for these expenditures going forward. But this will just basically ensure that the projects are selected through the PUC approval. The bill also states the PUC roles, which, as under current law, the PUC still retains the ultimate authority to approve or reject project proposals. However, this proposal gives the PUC the authority to reject proposals if they find the expenditures are not in the public interest. We're really gearing towards the public interest. It also talks about administrative costs. In language, one of the auditor's recommendations was to provide statutory language defining appropriate administrative cost. So this proposal explicitly allows the utility to spend up to 5% for administration of the fund. The auditor was very critical of the legislature appropriating money out of this fund. To date, the legislature has appropriated over $37 million, including IRE, and much of this money was spent on some non-electric projects, including $1 million for on-farm biogas, $2.5 million for the community for certs, $2 million for study of hybrid cards and retooling of the St. Paul 4 plant, $750,000 for preparing the hydrogen roadmap, $4.25 million for renewable energy research grants, $3 million for the E85 cost-sharing grants, $150,000 to study electric vehicles with advanced transmissions, $3.25 million for the Renewable Hydrogen Initiative, $50,000 for the analysis of geothermal heat pumps, and $25,000 to manage the Green Jobs Task Force. This proposal in front of you explicitly states that the legislature may not appropriate money from this fund once enacted. If the future legislature wants to do so, they may change the language, but we feel very strongly that it is not our job to do that. We should have just one authority, one board doing it, one advisory group, I should say. The REPI payments are beginning to tail off, and these have been, especially in these qualified wind projects, as the projects begin to tail off, there will be more money available, and that can be spent in the competitive bidding process. So this proposal explicitly states that any portion of the $10,900,000 set aside for REPI will automatically go back to the RDF fund for competitive bidding. There is an accountability and reports to the legislature. The auditor was very critical of the RDF program because there wasn't clear benefit to the ratepayers. So our proposal requires the utility to submit yearly reports to the committees with jurisdiction over energy policy. The reports must include the financial, environmental, and other benefits to the utilities ratepayers in the state. Also requested by the auditor, this proposal requires final reports to be posted online, accessible through a single public website. All reports must acknowledge that the work was made possible by, in whole or part, by the utilities ratepayers. We also repeal the 2003 law that gave the Department of Commerce and the PUC the ability to transfer the administrative duties of the account to an independent third party if they feel, after review, it is in the public interest to do so. So that's the snapshot of what I'm proposing here going forward, members. And with that, I think we will open it up to any questions at this time, members, if you have any. and then we can have some testimony. Okay, with that, we have Mr. Rick Evans with Xcel Energy. Welcome, Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with Government Affairs of Xcel Energy. We've provided in your packet I apologize for the thick stack of materials, but I'd like to, as I go through my testimony about the process that is used for the grant making in the current process, to refer to some of those documents. If you've already taken the clip off and taken them out of order, then we're all going to be really messed up. But if you kept them in roughly the order they were provided, they might still be messed up, but maybe a little less so. I want to spend just a moment going through a very brief history of the RDF that illustrated, for the context of some of my testimony. The chair has already gone through some of this, but as everybody knows, I think, this process was born out of the 1994 Prairie Island legislation, when Xcel was then NSP, was looking for the first time to store fuel in dry casks at the Prairie Island plant. And the resulting legislation was very voluminous. It was complicated. I wasn't here at the time, so I get no credit or blame for anything that was in there. But one of the elements of that was the establishment of the Renewable Development Fund. And if you go back and look at what the law said back in 1994, it was very brief. It did not provide very much detail at all. It said the money would be accrued. It said the money should be spent starting in 1999. It said it should be spent to develop renewable energy, and that was about it. That's all it said. And so when 1999 came along, the stakeholders who were interested in the Renewable Development Fund, including Xcel Energy, and the Minnesota legislature, changed the law in 1999, and it added one sentence, which was a critical sentence. What the sentence said was that expenditures should be approved by the Public Utilities Commission upon petition by the utility, that is Xcel Energy. Okay, we know how to do that. We file petitions with the PUC all the time. We request permission to do things. The PUC reviews the petition, has a public hearing, and issues an order. Okay, now we had a process. And that was set up in 1999 when the fund was supposed to start paying out money. Now, I didn't include this in your packet, but I just want to show you that since that time, the PUC does what administrative agencies do, and particularly what the PUC does, which is it issues orders. It says, okay, we've got this responsibility. Xcel, you've got this other responsibility. How are we going to do this? And so this, just to give you an idea, this is essentially the rule book. This is a collection of PUC orders over the years that are what we follow in terms of how we operate the fund. It's not haphazard. It's not random. It's not just whatever we feel like doing. It's based on a pretty detailed set of orders put down by the PUC over the years that tell us this is how you're going to spend the money out of the fund. And this is the process that we follow. I'd like to spend just a little time. Let me step back for one more minute and mention the advisory board. Originally, Xcel Energy and some of the stakeholders around the state who were concerned about how this money was going to be spent formed an advisory board. It was a group of people who, you know, we kind of get used around here to talking about stakeholders. This was a group of stakeholders. It was advisory only. It was to give us, you know, a way to percolate up ideas for how we were going to operate this fund. And eventually, that advisory board, which was never contained in the statute, was never ordered by the statute at any time along the way, eventually that advisory board became incorporated in these rules. And so now the advisory board currently operates under the PUC orders that have been added from time to time about who should be involved in the advisory board. So we appreciate the way the draft bill addresses that issue. We want to continue to use the advisory board. We think the PUC has set the right orders. We can add, you know, other people if there are, you know, customers or other people that should be represented on there. We can add those from time to time through the PUC orders. So we think the bill really, you know, hits the right note to say we want you to have this advisory board. And I think our record shows that we've had a good advisory board. We've used them well. So now I'm going to try and walk through the process that we go through, because I think it's important to understand this is what the legislative auditor looked at when it went through our process, and we showed them how we did this. So the first thing that happens is we gather the advisory group together, and we say we've got enough money. Usually we look for somewhere around $20 million, kind of a critical mass. We've collected enough money that it's worth putting out an RFP and asking for proposals from anybody who wants to propose. So what should the scope of that be? What kinds of things should we ask for? Should we focus on solar? Should we focus on wind? And this is, again, just for this round of grants, what should that look like? And after we have that advice from the advisory board, we put together a letter. And the first thing on your packet is a copy of a March 1st, 2007 letter. It's a letter that we send to the Public Utilities Commission, and we say we've met with our advisory board, and these are the kinds of things we want to proceed with in the next cycle of grants. This happened to be for cycle 3, the third cycle, which was the last cycle that we did. And we tell the PUC, this is what we plan to do. Another thing that's worth noting, I think, is there's the back couple of pages of that is a list of names and addresses. Anybody, any member of the public, any organization can go to the Public Utilities Commission and say, we want to be placed on the service list for the docket that has to do with the Renewable Development Fund. And so every time we file something with the Public Utilities Commission, all of these people get copies because they've asked to receive copies when we do this. And so, and of course, this letter becomes a public document once it's filed with the PUC and it's available on their website.
Mr. Evans, quick question. How much money do you have to, what's the normal range of money to accumulate before you can do an RFP?
You know, I think the group typically likes to have about $20 million. You want to have enough money to generate interest where proposers say, hey, I got a reasonable chance of getting some of this. And, you know, if it was only $1 million, you know, a lot of people probably wouldn't bother proposing because, you know, you're one out of 1,000. But we like to have a critical mass, and I think that the group has decided about $20 million is where we'd like to be before we actually issue an RFP. So once we've sent given the PUC notice of these are the kinds of things that we want to address in our next round of proposals, then we get back together and we put together a request for proposals or an RFP. The next document that you've got in your stack there is a little thicker document. The cover press release is dated May 16th, 2007. And this was the RFP, the request for proposals, that went out for cycle 3. This includes a lot of, first of all, what we do with this is we file it with the Public Utilities Commission. So it becomes a public document at that point on their website. We provide it to all of the people on the service list who were on that prior letter. In addition, we have a list of about 500 people who have asked us, who are potential proposers and have been asked to put on a list of potential proposers, and each of them receive a copy of the RFP. And then, as the top page indicates, we do a press release. So we rely on the news media to let everybody in the whole wide world know that we're looking for proposals. The RFP, the documents that are behind that cover, describe what kinds of projects we're looking for. It describes and it lays out a fairly extensive list of information we want to receive from proposers. We want their proposals to be solid and sound and provide all the information we need to make a good decision. We want a budget. We want to know who their key personnel are. We want to see that they're actually able to accomplish what they're going to accomplish. We want a good description of what they're going to try to accomplish. We want to see what their schedule is, their calendar, how fast are they going to get this done. All of those things are things that we ask them to fill out when they do the RFP. So when we get these back, we're getting solid information from all of the proposers that we can use to judge the proposals that come in. The next thing that happens is an employee of Xcel Energy, who's the RDF administrator, holds a meeting. And this is actually noticed in the RFP. We notice that we're having this meeting where any potential proposer can come in and meet with us and ask any questions of clarification, what kind of information you want, if there's some confusion or if they aren't sure what they should provide. So we give them an opportunity to come in and talk with us about what it is we're expecting to see when they make their proposals. And then the RFP also contains a deadline, and they have to submit proposals by that deadline. A completed proposal according to the lines of the RFP. Once we get those proposals, And it's a stack of documents pretty thick. We get lots of responses to our proposals. The RDF administrator in our office goes through them to make sure that they all meet the minimum qualifications, that they've provided all the information that we've asked for. This is not a screening process on the merits. This is just to make sure that each proposal is complete and that we've gotten all the information that we've asked for. And then two things happen at that point. The advisory board can get back together and start going through the proposals to familiarize themselves with the proposals, and we send them to the Princeton Energy Resources International LLC, which is a company in Rockville, Maryland, that we found through a competitive bidding process. These are people that have the kind of expertise, technical expertise, financial expertise, all of the things that they need to evaluate the proposals. And what we ask them to do is score the proposals on a set of criteria that we provide to them. This is the kind of expertise we don't have inside Xcel Energy. These folks are very expert at this. This is what they do. They can evaluate these very technical proposals, make sure that they're realistic, that their timelines are realistic, that their budgets are realistic, that they have the right kind of people involved to actually accomplish what they say they're going to accomplish. And they prepare a scoring for us. Again, they don't eliminate projects. They just give scores. And a little bit later, I think we'll get to a document that actually has that an example of one of their scoring sheets on there, so you'll see the kinds of things that they look at.
Does the Princeton Energy LLC, Mr. Evans, do they work? I know there's no other fund like this in the nation, but there are similar setups. Do they do it for other states? Do you know?
I don't know that, Madam Chair. I do have a sort of a little flyer printed off the web. I didn't put that in your materials, but I'd be happy to provide that. Gives you a little bit. I know. I'm sorry. We were trying to kill as few trees as possible.
No.
So these four pages, of course, were critical. But anyway, we can provide you with that information.
Senator McGuire, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick one.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. About how many people are on your docket to receive these now? I mean, is there a lot more than what we see? And this is a 2007 letter I see. Do you have a lot more people? Or I noticed that you put it out for put a press release out on it, and maybe I'm just not understanding this, but these people that are listed here, are these just the names of the people that are getting this notice, or what is this list?
So that's Madam Chair, Senator, that's the service list. Those are people who have requested to the PUC to be placed on the service list. So they receive a copy of everything that we file in this docket because, you know, they're interested for whatever reason.
And is it quite
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, is it a bit bigger now that it's, 5 years later?
Mr. Evans.
Just curious.
Madam Chair, Senator McGuire, I don't know that.
Okay.
I mean, the service list doesn't really change much over the
okay,
time, but obviously any new group that was interested
okay,
could be placed on the service list. And this is different from the list of over 500 people and groups and organizations that have asked to be informed when an RFP is issued.
Okay, that's
a different list of people.
Okay.
They are not interested in seeing a lot of the things that are filed. They want to see an RFP when a proposal is actually being issued, and they have something to respond to because that's what they're interested in.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was actually my next question was, is this the RFP list? So there's about 500, you say, that might be on that list approximately. That's what I was wondering, how many people are on the list, and then how many proposals do you usually get? Maybe you'll get to that point.
Madam Chair, Senator McGuire, I don't have the answer to that
okay,
question, but I might have somebody who does. So we'll see if we can track that down for you, and I'll let you know.
We can accumulate some of these questions,
yeah,
and then
right,
and if we need to get someone else up,
thank you, Madam
to answer
Chair,
all that, would be great. Mr. Evans,
thank you, Madam after we've sent this off to PERI, and they've provided us with their scoring of these, and that's, again, another stack of documents about twice as big because it includes all the proposals plus all of their background documentation based on their analysis. And then the advisory group that has already started looking through the proposals then has all the tools that it needs to give us advice on what projects to accept. Or what projects to propose. And so they spend a lot of time. Each of them gets this full set of documents, and they go through looking at the scoring, looking at what PERI has had to say about each of the proposals, and, you know, basing the proposals on their own preferences, their own understanding. I mean, these people are typically very knowledgeable about what's going on. They've learned as they've sat on the advisory board or come with their own knowledge, if they're environmental groups, for example. And so the evaluation is made, and again, the group, strictly on an advisory basis, advises us on what proposals we should make then to the PUC. Now, I can say that it's a very collaborative process. We don't take votes. We work together and by and large, have reached consensus among the advisory group on what kinds of proposals should go forward. And then the next thing that we do, and this is the next document that's in your stack, I believe, is it's a December 6, 2007 letter. And this is the filing that we make to the PUC where we – this happened to be the Cycle 3 grants – where we submitted it to the PUC and said, these are the projects that we would like to fund with this cycle of funding through the RDF. And this is a document that then goes to the PUC. It becomes a public document. It's provided to all of the members of the service list who've requested to receive the document. This is the one, actually, if you look on the last four pages of this document, this is the one that shows the four or five pages, I guess, shows the grid, a sample of the grid that we get from PERI and how they've gone through, what they've scored, what the criteria are they've looked at. I don't think, this is an example. I don't think we actually have the scoring on here, but it gives you an idea of the kinds of things that PERI goes through, and this is, you know, a fairly extensive document, and they've got the backup that goes with this to evaluate the proposals that we've received. And that's what the advisory group uses, along with Xcel Energy, to determine which proposals should move forward. And then this is a document. This petition is heard in a public meeting before the Public Utilities Commission. And so any member of the public can come in to the Public Utilities Commission, can have input on the document. They can say they picked the wrong things, they picked the right things, they shouldn't have picked this one, they should have picked that one, they've spent too much money on this, not enough on that. And all of that public testimony is provided to the Public Utilities Commission based on the petition that we filed. So it's a very open and public process by which the petition is approved or disapproved. We've been very fortunate that for the most part they've been approved by the PUC, but it is a very open process where people can come in from the public and have an input in how this is done. And then the Public Utilities Commission issues an order which tells us which grants we have permission. This is again under the statute going back to 1999. Money will be spent pursuant to a PUC order. And so we receive an order from the Public Utilities Commission telling us which ones we can go forward on. At that point, we sit down with the proposer and we sign a contract. I forgot to mention one of the other items that's in the RFP, that second document we looked at, is a fairly extensive contract so that every proposer knows that if they get selected for this, they're going to have to sign that contract. That contract sets out how they're going to get paid, how they're going to show us they're meeting their benchmarks and milestones, what we expect to get from them by way of reports over time, what we expect to get by way of a final report, under what circumstances we might not pay them the money, because our money is not paid out in a lump sum up front. Our money is paid out based on milestones that are achieved by the projects. And as they demonstrate that they've achieved the milestones, then we can make payments.
Those milestones are set by the PUC?
The milestones are set in the proposal. That's one of the things we ask them to do, is set milestones, and then that's part of what's evaluated by us. When are you going to – what is it you're going to accomplish, and when are you going to accomplish them? They make frequent, in fact, monthly reports through the whole time of their project. They make monthly reports to us to show us that they're meeting their milestones. And if they don't meet their milestones, they're not going to get their money. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the process that we go through on this. But after they've been selected and the order comes from the PUC, then we sit down with each of them and they sign their contract and we walk through with them what it is we expect from them and how it is that they're going to go about submitting their reports and getting their money. Our RDF program administrator requires monthly milestone reports showing their progress and makes payments based on completion of milestones. And then there's an annual report. They have to file a report annually, each project, to show us that they're making progress. The next document in your pile there is this longer document with sort of a graph on the front and then a lot of very small, unreadable comments on the back. This is the document that is kept on every project by our RDF grant administrator. And it's his comments. The graph is essentially a timeline showing the milestones that they're meeting, when they've met them, if they're behind or if they're ahead. And then the comments in the fine print on the back are essentially the notes of our RDF grant administrator, where he, you know, makes comments about his monthly meetings, his monthly reports, you know, what's going on with the project, so that we have one. And we have one of these for every one of the projects that we've done, where we've kept track right up until the project is completed to make sure that they're doing what they said they were going to do in their proposal and that it's being done according to the contract that they've signed with us upon receiving the award.
Has the grant administrator had to pull any of those contracts where they weren't meeting their milestones or their benchmarks? Is that that's another question. We'll
another question.
On our list.
Yeah,
okay.
I know that our RDF administrator, who happens to sit right outside of my office, this is his job, to make sure that these folks are doing what they need to do, and he keeps on top of them. It has happened. I know that groups have not met their milestones. And that requires us to sit down and find out what the problem is, you know. And sometimes it's a temporary problem, a little glitch they didn't expect, and sometimes it could be a bigger problem. But I can get that information for you.
Okay.
And then the last thing that is required under the contract for our proposals is that they submit a final report and give us an analysis of the information what they've accomplished, essentially, with our money. I have a copy here. This is a company called WindLogix. They won. This is not in part of your materials, but we could provide it to you if you're interested. WindLogix did a project for us for the RDF, finding new ways to forecast wind. It's an important part of the wind industry. The more that we as a utility can forecast the availability of wind, the better we're able to manage it in relationship to all our other assets. WindLogix is a St. Paul company. They actually conducted the study down in Lake Benton. They received a grant from us, and this report, which I'd be happy to share with you if you'd like, you know, contains essentially this is the result of their grant. This is the result of their work. And every proposal, every project that we have is required to submit one of these in return for having gotten the money. So we have a final report from every project telling us what they learned, what they found out, what they accomplished in return for the money that they received from the Renewable Development Fund. And then under current law, we are required every 2 years to report to the legislature. And the last two documents in your packet are these two bound documents. This, you can see from the cover, this is the 2007 to 2008 projects, and then the second one is the 2009-2010 project. The earlier one is the one with the St. John's Solar Farm on the cover, and the other one doesn't have a picture on the cover. One of the things you'll find in here, and I think in the one with the St. John's picture on the cover, if you look after page 23, that's the beginning of Appendix A. And Appendix A has a list of all the grants that were made in that two-year period and what the status of the grants are, what, you know, very, very briefly, what their area of concentration was and what the projected end date is for that project. So you can see there the list, and then there's a similar appendix in the second report that shows the list of all the projects that were funded through this process that I've just finished describing. We think that given the results of the legislative auditor's report and the freeze on the RDF that was put in place last year, that this is a good time to reboot this system. And so we welcome the new legislation, the new direction from the legislation, so that we can get the RDF back up and running. And I say back up and running, and I'll explain that comment in a minute. We think the process we've got here is competitive. We think it's accountable. We think it's collaborative. We think it's open to the public. And, of course, it is supervised by the Public Utilities Commission, our regulating agency. So we think it provides a lot of safety and security for the ratepayers of Minnesota, and also a lot of good value and confidence that you can have that the projects are being selected appropriately, and that these are the best projects that we can have. The auditor noted that I think if you read through the auditor's report, while there were some things that they noted that we could improve in our process, for the most part they found our process to be, I think it's fair to say, the best process by which money has been granted, because they recognized it was an open, transparent, collaborative project process that is accountable to the public and to our customers. And then, as the chair mentioned in your opening comments, the auditor's report did mention the fact that the account has become disjointed. And by disjointed, the auditor was referring to all of the various earmarks that have been taken out of the fund over the years to be used for various purposes. The REPI you mentioned, the Ag Utilization Research Institute, the Excelsior Energy Project, the NextGen Board, the IRE at the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Manufactured Solar. So those kinds of appropriations or earmarks have been taken out of the fund over the years. And the result was, for the last 4 years, we never got, in our process, the critical mass to make a fourth cycle round of grants. We've just now gotten to that point where we have about $19.5 million in the account, or we can see where we can get that, and we can start thinking about a round of grants. But the reason there haven't been any grants out of this fund through our process for the last 4 years is because the fund has been, essentially, the money has been removed from the account by the various earmarks that have been taken out of the account over the years. And so we appreciate the opportunity in the draft bill that we saw to sort of reboot this system and say, you know what, let's see if we can let this process work the way it was intended. I think it's a good process. I think it's a process that's accountable and all of those things. But let's see if we can let that work and stop the practice of taking earmarks out of the fund that essentially prevent the fund from doing what it was set up to do. And we think this, you know, this is a good time, because of the legislative auditor's report and the freeze, to sort of reboot the system. Now, we're not recommending that we stop any of the stream of payments that are going to REPIs through the REPI and the Minnesota bonus. I think that's the Minnesota Made Solar. That would be disruptive of programs that are out there. So we understand that those are going to have to tail out. But those are in the process of tailing out, and it will restore the fund then to what we think will be a much more vigorous process, and we can start really making grants on a regular schedule rather than the sort of stop and start that we've done. I want to emphasize here that by saying that, I in no way mean, Excel does not mean to criticize any of the programs that have received money. There's always going to be a good program looking for money. Mm-hmm. The problem in our mind with the process of earmarking is that once you've done it, it's hard to stop. Once you've given one group a jump to the head of the line for the RDF money, there's really no principled reason to stop the next group and the next group and the next group.
Madam Chair.
With all due respect.
Senator Mitzel.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Evans. On Appendix A, a couple of these projects were let to apparently University of North Dakota, three different ones, and then I don't know where Coltech Energy is located. Is there, number one, do we have to go out of state when these people, do we accept bids or proposals from all over? Or could there be a preference for Minnesota-based companies? Or why do we have to go to North Dakota with about $4 million here in this fund?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Senator Metzen, the one thing I'll say, and I can't comment on any of those specifically, but from time to time there are projects that are actually conducted in Minnesota but conducted by institutions outside of Minnesota. So in some ways the money does stay. But the other thing I would say is that we don't have any objection to a provision that the money should be used focused in Minnesota. That's not been one of the criteria that we've used. It's not part of the statute, and it's not part of the rules, the orders that we get from the Public Utilities Commission. So We open the process up to people who want to bid, and we rate the proposals based on their merits. So I know that there has been criticism in the legislature, and I understand that. To the extent that money has left the state, you know, this money has left the state, and I think that's an appropriate thing for the legislature to address in its policy, in terms of how the money should be spent.
Madam Chair,
Yep, I think that clearly states in the bill, in the draft.
The public utility must strongly consider, where reasonable, potential benefit to Minnesota citizens and businesses. So there is some language or in existence that at least doesn't say they shall, but at least there's some kind of language in there that
if you go to page 2, line 5, or start with paragraph C, funds in the account may be expended only to increase the market penetration within the state of renewable electric energy resources at reasonable costs, promote the startup expansion. Then you go again several times on line 7, within the state. It's a good discussion. Do you want to specifically say in there only for projects within Minnesota? I think that clearly states in that paragraph. However, if you need it more defined, then it opens up that question of what about the partnerships that perhaps the company has? And I think, outside of the state or with some other research firm. But I think that we clearly need to address that OLA report with that, saying those funds, you cannot have University of North Dakota cleaned up $2 million there in biomass.
$3 million, it looks like.
Or $3 million, okay. Yeah, $3 million.
And I don't know, Madam Chair, where that Coal Tech Energy is.
Right.
There's the next one.
Yeah. Mr. Evans?
Okay, well, Madam Chair, would it just look at that and consider it?
This has always irked you, hasn't it? You've brought this up a couple times. That
grown and born and everything in Minnesota.
Minnesota ratepayers. Mm-hmm. Let's spend
ratepayers.
It here.
I'm looking out for the ratepayers.
There you go.
So that's it. Thanks for the help. Yeah.
But thank you, though, Senator Metzen. Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, while we're looking at that page, I do think it's worth noting. I know all my friends from the University of Minnesota are here, and I know that they would like to have an earmark out of the fund that we would prefer not be made. But I would note that if you look at the combination of these two reports, through our competitive process, the University of Minnesota has gotten about $8 million in grants. So, the University of Minnesota is terrific at applying for grants. They've got experts at it. They're good at it. And we've awarded a fair amount of money through our process to the University of Minnesota. So I hope my comments weren't taken as any criticism of the University of Minnesota. As a graduate twice from the University of Minnesota, I'm a big fan of the university. But we do think that once you start down the path of taking money out of the fund to earmark for certain groups, there's always going to be another good idea for what to do with this money. And we would really like to see this move forward along the lines that the bill proposes, where we would be able to use this money in the manner it was intended through the process that we've provided, with whatever other guidance the legislature would like to give us on how to run the process.
And Mr. Evans, that's a very good point, and it's been a struggle to come to that conclusion. I have a project down at Minnesota State University that I would love to see funded through this, but it is. Once you go down that path, it's very hard to put the brakes on, and every project that we'd like to see funded does have the ability to go through the proper process. But there's some wonderful things out there, but that's the purpose of this bill, is to just basically pull it in, streamline it, make it fair for everybody.
Madam Chair, that's all I had, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Any questions? Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just looking at the makeup of the advisory board that makes these decisions, and I see the list of current advisory board members, and I understand that you pick that Xcel Energy picks the advisory board members, if that's correct. Mm-hmm. And so then I noticed that it says that now in addition to consulting, or the commission may require that other interests be represented on the advisory group. So is there anything in the statute or anything that would say, you know, there should be a representative of this interest and this interest and this interest. Or it appears as though, and I certainly trust that Excel will always do the right thing, but that they would have certain interests that would dominate on a board like this. I mean, one could anticipate that could happen. So what protections might be there so that a certain interest might not have a majority on this advisory board?
Madam Chair, Senator McGuire, the kinds of people that are on the board are now dictated by PUC order. Mm. So we recruit the people, but for example, it was a PUC order that said, for example, the Prairie Island Indian Tribe should have a representative on the board, and they select a person to do that. The DER has a representative on the board. They represent residential customers. That's part of their charge, and so they come and do that. Chamber of Commerce has a seat on the board because they represent the large commercial and industrial customers. So the makeup of the board is currently actually not selected by us. It's dictated by a PUC order.
So
that's a very good question, Senator McGuire, because that was actually, we spent a lot of time on this board makeup because that was my concern too. And there is, if the PUC wanted to have the environmental advocate on there, that's not necessarily a ratepayer. That maybe comes from someplace else. Well, that you certainly can do that with that. So we did not want to make this so tight that we'd have to go to state gov or no, just joking.
Well, but, no. Actually, Madam Chair and Senator, that's really a very good point. We've been concerned because at the times that the board gets mentioned in legislation, you know, that it would start becoming something like a state board. Mm-hmm. And be subject to all the requirements of various state boards. It's an advisory board. It's not public money. It's private money.
Right.
And we want to really try to keep that line fairly bright. As the legislative auditor pointed out, this is a very unusual situation of public-private partnership or collaboration. And so our concerns about the board is the more it turns into something like a state board, the less useful it might become. Having said that, you know, this is an advisory board, and they are the people who percolate up the ideas and help us evaluate this. So we're not interested in restricting it. You know, we want to have good representation on the board, and we've been very happy with the way the board has operated.
Okay, Senator Jumbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Evans. I'm wondering if we know. It seems like there's a lot of paperwork, like anything. And we have in our bill something that mentions about 5% to cover administrative costs. Do we know what it costs to do administrative in general?
I can get that information for you. I do think, I mean, that's one of the questions we have with the board, because in a year when we're actually doing a grant cycle, we would probably exceed 5%. But then in a year when we weren't doing a grant cycle, we probably would not exceed 5%. So that's one of the pieces as the bill moves forward, we'd like to have some more consultation with. You know, we have one employee who's dedicated, the RDF grant administrator, who's dedicated to this process. But, of course, we pay the Princeton group to do the evaluations, and there are other costs that are associated with it.
Senator Jumper.
And we will get you the specific information.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that, Mr. Evans, do you know what it costs per project on average to have the Princeton group evaluate projects?
I don't, but I'll get that information for the committee as well.
Thank you.
I hope Mr. Edmund is taking notes. And he'll get back to us. Thank you. That's great. Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, two questions. One, the amounts that you have on here for the University of Minnesota, is that in addition to the earmark, or is that because of the earmark?
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, no, that's in addition. Those are grants that were awarded to the University of Minnesota based on a proposal that they put in. So the $5 million that was taken, you know, for however many years from the fund to give the university was not part of this grant process. That was a separate – it was in addition.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair. And would Excel have any strong opposition, at, you know, to the membership of the advisory board? I see that the host communities where their storage IFAC is located at aren't represented on there. Would there be any strong opposition to having them or someone representing them?
Mr. Evans.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, the more the merrier. I think, you know, we're looking for, you know, within reason. I mean, we don't have to hold the meetings in an auditorium, but I think, you know, the kinds of input that we want from people, they can help us percolate ideas.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions?
Oh, there's a...
Thank you, Mr. Evans. We might be calling you up again.
Another minute.
And then we have Mr. Dick Hemmingson, the Managing Director for Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment.
Technology.
A little technology problem. Oh, issue. Well, okay, okay. How long do you think? Let's see.
Oops.
You know what? Then, and if you don't mind, Mr. Hampson, I think maybe we'll bring up Aaron Stojan Ricolo with Fresh Energy. If we can make that fairly quickly, we can get you set up while she's. Welcome, Stojan Ricolo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did I say it right? Please tell me.
It was very close.
Let's go. It's good enough for me.
My name is Erin Stojan Ricolo. I'm a senior policy associate with Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a 20-year-old nonprofit organization that works to develop and advocate for energy policies to diversify and strengthen the energy system in Minnesota, the Midwest, and the nation. Fresh Energy worked on the legislation that established the Renewable Development Fund in 1994. Our understanding has always been that as part of the negotiated compromise that authorized dry cask storage of spent nuclear waste, the legislature made a commitment to help emerging electricity generation technologies to develop and become commercially viable. Over the time, of course, the need for diversifying our electricity generation resources has become only more urgent. The advantages, economic, environmental, and logistical of a more diverse and robust electricity generation mix are now very clear. The RDF provides a very small amount of money in the world of electricity generation, but it can have significant benefits for ratepayers and for advancing emerging electricity technologies. It's funded some very interesting and beneficial projects over time. Perhaps the funds have not always found their way to the best projects, as noted in the legislative auditor's report. But the portion of the funds allocated through the original process, which we heard from Mr. Evans, Xcel Energy proposing projects for PUC approval, seems to have worked quite well over time. We at Fresh Energy support responding to the inadequacies and glitches identified in the report. We're happy to see the interest and time that you and others have dedicated to this issue. This bill draft is a good starting point. We do have some concerns, and we look forward to working with you to make the RDF better. Thank you very much.
Ms. Stojan Ricolo, can you tell me what they are?
Sure. We're specifically concerned that, first of all, the draft language deletes the language that continues the fund after the plant closes if the owner does not continue to seek removal of the stored waste. We're also worried that the draft language allows for spending for utility infrastructure efficiency, which, of course, is a little bit different than renewable technologies. And then thirdly, we want to make sure that we maintain a decision-making process that works. We want to make sure that we don't put too high of a burden, I guess, on the Public Utilities Commission in deciding how to approve or deny projects.
You think it's been a burden to this point?
I don't think it's been a burden, but we want to make sure that the Public Utilities Commission has had adequate guidance in terms of how to approve and deny projects up until this point. And so we would like to work with you in terms of looking at whether or not that should be changed.
Okay. I guess I'm a little confused because I'm not sure what kind of guidance, what else we could do besides an advisory group that's giving the guidance. Do you have any suggestions? But perhaps we can meet afterwards because that's a little vague, a little nebulous on that.
Sure.
I don't understand that. I can understand the other ones, but actually I think the PUC is probably welcoming a chance to keep this streamlined and know what direction these funds will be dictated.
I'd be happy to discuss it with you further.
Thank you. Any questions for them? Okay, thank you very much for coming up. All right, Mr. Hammingson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dick Hammingson with the Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment at the University of Minnesota, and I'm pleased to have the opportunity to spend at least a few minutes with you today talking about some of the results that have occurred as a result of the investments that have been made in research and development across a broad spectrum of renewable energy opportunities. And, whoops, I told you this was going to happen.
The short answer is this. And that new knowledge creates businesses, lifts communities, and changes lives. And here's the key. It's not just our faculty that produce new knowledge. Just look at what these University of Minnesota students are doing. Joseph is helping create an artificial cornea that will be implantable in patients worldwide. Ashley is testing the effects of wastewater on neighboring farmlands. Nick is designing software for prototype toys his team will present to kids and industry professionals. Lindsay is finding out whether a tiny bug could endanger Minnesota's 930 million ash trees. Jared is creating molecular storage devices for electronics. Jeff is monitoring the health of streams along the North Shore. Scott is designing an underwater turbine that will produce power without having to dam a river. Abby is analyzing markets to help small businesses grow. Carolyn created a volunteer program to bring healthcare to the homeless while she completed medical school and trained for the Olympics. Toby is experimenting with energy-producing crops that will maintain soil quality. Summer is extending the art of storytelling through dance and choreography. Two-thirds of these students will stay here when they graduate. They'll be our leaders and our entrepreneurs. They'll be our smart workforce for new and growing industries. They'll be our teachers and healers, our artists and engineers. They'll make Minnesota a vibrant place to live.
Problems?
Yes, I am. I can't move along. I might be finished, Madam Chair.
Take the cursor out of the box.
Okay.
And then
there we go. Well, so thank you, and my apologies. That's not obviously one of my fortes. I'm just going to spend a few minutes with a few sort of really high-level examples of some of the impacts these investments have had at the university, spend just a few minutes on a couple of specific examples and make a few concluding comments, and then be, of course, more than happy to respond to any questions. So this initiative at the University of Minnesota, consistent with the authorizing language that provided these resources to the university, essentially, as you see, focuses here on developing economic benefits, energy security benefits, and environmental benefits by developing a full array of renewable energy systems. This is just a snapshot that gives you a sense of the portfolio of investments that IRE's made since the initial funding was made available to us back in 2003. And you can see that consistent, again, with the language authorizing these expenditures at the university and consistent with the strengths we have as a university, that's sort of the picture to date in terms of the balance amongst the various aspects of the portfolio. And I certainly want to take this opportunity, Madam Chair and members, to thank this committee and members of the legislature for allowing us to continue the RFP that we were in the middle of a year ago. And as a result of having those funds available, this is just a quick summary of the quantity of interest within the university. We funded a number of what we call large grants. These are typically two or three-year multi-investigator projects. You can see the number of submittals we had and the number of proposals we awarded. A couple of years ago, we started a portion of these investments aimed at early career faculty to try to encourage faculty who are newer in their career at the university to participate in seed grants. And that portfolio, you can see the results of a significant shift from historical patterns in terms of a greater emphasis based on the quality proposals, for example, on solar research. An area that comes perhaps as a surprise to some people, but of really significant strength in terms of the academic research capacity of the University of Minnesota, and frankly, I would say an underappreciated and certainly underutilized resource for us here in this part of the country. So again, thank you for the opportunity to continue. That was the results of it. One of the impacts that these funds have enabled our faculty to significantly leverage additional research funding to the state of Minnesota. Since the beginning of these funds, you can see the IRE investments at the bottom part of the chart, and then the externally leveraged funds from mostly federal funding agencies, but also industrial partners and so forth are part of that figure. So about $70 million, in fact, that number is a little higher since this chart was prepared, since the beginning. But what is perhaps more interesting, to me at least, is another portion of our investments is what we call matching funds. These are a portion of these funds that we set aside to enable the university to come up with the cost share requirements, particularly, for example, for the Department of Energy. A research proposal submitted there, the institution has to provide 20% of the costs of the project. So significant portion of these IRE funds have been utilized to help the institution, you know, provide that cost share. And those funds are heavily leveraged. And one of the clear advantages of these funds at the University of Minnesota is the internal investments that we've made, like those I showed in the previous slide, oftentimes enable our faculty to do some preliminary work, to get a proof of concept, to enable them to be significantly more competitive in these federal funding opportunities. In fact, in our current matching grant portfolio, those that are active, that is, the external funding agency has reviewed and approved them, the leveraging ratio recently on those is a 1-to-12 ratio. And the leveraging ratio on those that are currently pending, we've reviewed them, approved them, waiting for a decision by the external funding entity. If all of those were to be awarded, we hope they are, probably won't be, that ratio is 1-to-19. And so the point is that the capacity of our faculty to increasingly leverage external funds is ramped up considerably as a result of these core investments we've made. And I might mention while I'm thinking of it, while our internal RFP process can be episodic, we typically do that once a year or every other year, and could time that to be consistent with set of priorities established by an RDF board or whatever. These funds are very episodic. We don't know until the RFP comes out, and typically we have to respond very quickly. So if we were to have to wait for, some extended period of time to apply for or to be able to receive funds to use for this purpose, most of these leveraged funds simply wouldn't happen in the way they have been. A few other metrics. As a result of these funds, if you add up the faculty members, the research associates, the graduate students, the postdocs, the undergraduate students, the lab technicians that have engaged in renewable energy research at your University of Minnesota as a result of the investments we've been able to make out of these funds, that community of scholars now is right at 600 people across the University of Minnesota actively engaged in developing renewable energy technologies for tomorrow. One of the clear missions and purposes of any university, ours included, is to train the scientists of the future. So as a result of the investments in research projects that we have been able to make as a result of these funds, we have trained 276 postdocs, graduate students, and undergraduate students who have been actively engaged on research projects funded by these projects. 110 of those have received advanced degrees, master's or PhD degrees, with several more in the pipeline. And so that's been another significant impact of these funds within the university. And, of course, a wide array of external collaborators on various and sundry projects, from Fortune 500 companies to, I use the words here, pre-startup. Sometimes people just with a good idea that aren't even yet at the startup stage. And we work very hard at that. My colleague Rod Larkins is here. That's what he spends the most of his time on, is working on developing these collaborations. Well, to move just to a couple of examples out of the 250-plus research projects that we funded, this Aeolus Wind Energy Research Consortium is a really stunning example of the impact of these funds. Early on in IRE's existence, there are probably a dozen or so faculty within the university who received funding on various aspects of big wind, big as in the large turbines. And while a lot of people might think that's a pretty mature industry, in fact, as these turbines get larger and larger, there are some significant challenges. And so we had made investments in things like better gearboxes and hydrostatic transmissions and greater efficiency on the drives and so on and so forth. And in 2008, I believe it was, the Department of Energy released a solicitation for establishing wind energy research consortiums. And the RFP indicated they were going to fund two of these in the country, two of these research consortiums. They were initially to be funded at $12 million each of DOE funding. Dr. Soter-Polis, who was here, is the lead PI on that, along with these faculty, but even more importantly, with a strong contingent. In fact, I should point out in your folder, the U of M folder, there is a handout, a one-page, two-side handout, which talks more specifically about this particular project. But our faculty, in conjunction with industrial partners, 3M, WinLogix, Honeywell, Bahr Engineering, Lockheed Martin, and others, together put together a proposal to respond to this DOE solicitation. And the Department of Energy found it compelling enough. They actually awarded three of these proposals, one of which is here at the University of Minnesota. And in fact, if you've driven down Highway 52 on the Umore Park near the old munitions plant, you've no doubt seen the new Clipper turbine that is established there. That's the research site for the field station of this facility. These are the current projects that are underway as a result of the DOE funding, and a photograph of the turbine and the Met Tower on site. This is an example of something else we focused really hard on, both within the university and developing interdisciplinary teams to address these issues of renewable energy systems. And in your handout, you'll see the list of external partners. But what might be even more important is the access that we have obtained to D&E, to the DOE, and to other national labs as a result of this funding by the DOE is really put us on the map, as it were, in terms of renewable energy research. And so Dr. Soter-Polis's associate just sent me this list this morning. Beyond those core research projects that are underway, and I apologize for the small type, a whole list of either developing or underway already additional research opportunities that are here as a result of this research facility being here, partnerships with Sandia National Labs, with the National Renewable Energy Labs Wind Center in Golden, Colorado. In fact, we were visiting just before the meeting. We are hearing early words of yet another significant opportunity in this space that people are now coming to us, to Dr. Soter-Polis, to partner with us to prepare a proposal for what we think will be a forthcoming major solicitation from the Department of Energy. So not to say anything of the results of this research, the shark skin coating that 3M is looking at to significantly reduce drag and improve efficiency of the turbines. Bahr Engineering's part is looking at the sensors in the foundation to determine as these turbines get larger and larger how much engineering is needed. WinLogix's approach, the company many of you know, is obvious. LIDAR interference for radar settings on wind farms and Honeywell's contribution of using their technology current deployed in helicopter rotors to sense failure in these turbine blades, hopefully before they occur. So addressing some real challenges in what many might view as a mature industry wind. So I apologize if I didn't do you proper justice, but that's a quick overview of that example. And I want to mention just a couple of others. I know many of you have heard about the wind to hydrogen project out at Morris at the West Central Research and Outreach Center. And as a result of IRE funding and other funding provided by the legislature, some bonding money, some LCCMR appropriations in the past, a USDA grant that our faculty achieved, the concept here, as many of you recall, is to utilize the wind-generated electrons to electrolyze water, a century-old process. You know, the Norwegians invented it a number of years ago, so no exciting technology there. But then to convert that renewable hydrogen, if you will, to anhydrous ammonia, a major source of crop nutrients for many of the crops globally. And so that was the original concept, looking at renewable hydrogen to produce ammonia. Among the technical challenges is doing this at small scale. as opposed to these mega refineries that you see in terms of reforming natural gas, which is the source. So the idea, the concept of renewable anhydrous ammonia is a very intriguing one. Well, as a result, frankly, of one of these new investments we were able to make with this last round of investments, another group of faculty in the Department of Chemical Engineering took a hard look at another nearly century-old process, the Haber-Bosch process, the process by which once you get the hydrogen and using compression have extracted the nitrogen from the atmosphere, the forming of them together to form anhydrous ammonia is this Haber-Bosch process. Another colleague of mine is a chemical engineer, so I took him at his word that this was the greatest technology innovation of the 20th century. I would have thought maybe hybrid corn might have been in that list or something, but I'll take him at his word. Clearly a significant process, centuries old. What our group is looking at and has discovered that that process of forming anhydrous ammonia is a very inefficient process, maybe 20-25% efficient because of the losses under high pressure. Their technology, which is under the patent development, and by the way, that is another chemical engineer's dream, a process flow diagram. The significance of this technology, as my colleague John Sheehan describes it, potentially all but could be eliminated in that Haber-Bosch process except what's in the shaded yellow area and increase the efficiency of that process by 3 to 4 times. If that's successful, not only would it revolutionize our concept of renewable hydrogen, whether from wind or biomass, as the folks at Wilmer are looking at, but this traditional reforming of natural gas. So there's an example of these resources at work and some other approaches in addition to this refined Haber-Bosch process, looking at a non-thermal plasma reactor, which is another methodology to convert hydrogen or to create hydrogen potentially would be very flexible in terms of the Haber-Bosch process. Once you start it, it's steady. This could allow to match, for example, the periodicity of winds and looking at the economic evaluation of what these renewable nitrogen fertilizers. One final example is in bio. I oftentimes talk about our efforts in bioenergy, that we need to have a capital B and a capital E on that term. All sources of biomass and all sources of energy. So one example here is with our colleagues at the Natural Resources Research Institute looking at a torrefaction, a processing methodology for biomass. And they've dubbed it bio-coal for combined heat and power. And this is just a flow diagram here. Essentially what you do is very flexible in terms of feedstocks, reduce these feedstocks to something that would look sort of like ground-up charcoal in terms of its consistency, but it homogenizes, if you will, the biomass to get away from the problems that many of you are aware of, feeding corn stover, wheat straw, wood pulp, very different processes. This just homogenizes all that biomass and overcomes the feedstock variability. It's a highly efficient conversion process. Making charcoal, you lose maybe 50% of the energy content. Here you save at least 90% of the energy content of the feedstock. Makes it very compatible for coal feeding, for example, in a coal-fired facility. Significantly improved emissions profile for the biomass component of such a situation. Obviously lowered greenhouse gas emissions and obviously taking advantage of locally sourced feedstocks. A number of collaborators here, in addition to the faculty on NRI, some economists in biosystems and ag engineering folks in the Twin Cities campus are associated with that, and also Michigan Tech and a couple of Minnesota-based companies part of that. So that's just a couple quick examples, just a few concluding comments. Also in your packet, there's another one-pager that we've given some thought to, sort of what the future for renewable energy in Minnesota might look like. And honestly, if you think about Minnesota, I think is positioned to be, if you will, the Silicon Valley of renewable energy because of our resources, both physical, air, wind, water, wind, solar, geothermal, and our human resources, certainly those at the University of Minnesota as well as those in our private sector and our NGO community and government sector. We really are poised, we think, to position ourselves as the Silicon Valley, as a state that can keep more of its energy dollars at home. You know, in spite of some significant accomplishments with respect to wind and certain areas of biofuels, we still, for the most part, export energy dollars to import our energy. And by developing the resources that we have, we think we can begin to turn that around and keep more of our energy dollars at home. And thinking conceptually about how this research and development, if you will, commercialization continuum, needs to be integrated with the academic research continuum across the line with a lot of communication. And certainly we are more than open to having further discussions about how the efforts that we have historically done with these funds might be better aligned with the overall objectives of the use of these particular funds, and to ensure that the business opportunities, needs, and objectives, and those of the public are closely integrated with helping to direct the nature of the research, and conversely, the research expertise helping to inform what some of those possibilities might be. And that's why we spend so much time developing these collaborative partnerships.
Okay, so we need to wrap this up a little bit, and we do have some questions for you.
All right. So let me conclude with this slide and the next one, Madam Chair. The work is not done. You know, while we've had good success, we still have a relatively small portion of our energy use from renewables, and we need to continue that. And we stand ready on the research and development arm of that continuum to serve this state. With that, I will conclude, and I apologize for getting a bit carried away, Madam Chair.
Well, you're just excited about some of the research. Obviously, we should probably just have a whole hearing on some of the things that are happening at the University of Minnesota.
Name the day, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Seriously. I do have a question, though. It's not, there is a tremendous amount of movement going on at the University of Minnesota, but what stops the U from applying for one of these grants and moving forward and perhaps doing it in such a manner that there is a little more long-term funding, like a 2 or 4 year funding? I know Mr. Evans was saying that they haven't had a cycle recently because of all the required, the committed dollars going out. So now we have a cycle coming up. But if those commitments are starting to wane and there's going to be more money infused back into the fund, I personally think it would be exciting for the advisory group to know what's going on at the U and to be able to make their commitment to the U through that without us as the legislature getting involved in that.
That certainly would be a possibility, and should that at the end of the day become the policy, I would imagine that faculty and others would be making application there. I do think that it's not that one is good or one is bad. That's not what I mean at all. But I think it is a different process to evaluate proposals at the further to the left end of the basic research and development continuum than further down that development continuum. One question that, or concern that I would have is the one I mentioned earlier, is that our capacity that we've had, at least, to respond to these federal funding opportunities is very episodic. I mean, the RFP will come out and probably have a month or something like that to respond. So nimbleness with respect to what has been our part of that portfolio, you know, might be a challenge under waiting for some particular cycle of some other board. And so that would be a particular concern.
Mm-hmm. However, being prudent with some of the dollars that have been allocated through the grant process might be good, too.
Pardon me?
Being prudent with some of the dollars, you know, not necessarily having to spend them immediately.
Yeah.
But any questions from anybody else, sir? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Hemmingson. We spoke recently, and we talked a little bit about IRE and its impact on you know, kind of present day impact on the number, and you presented some of the numbers, researchers, et cetera, and some of the future impact potentially in terms of turning ideas into careers and into jobs and into businesses in Minnesota, you know, kind of carrying on the long, rich legacy of the University of Minnesota that brought us the medical device industry, that brought us the, you know, the iron ore industry, and so, you know, so many other important businesses and, you know, a lot of the economic prosperity that we do enjoy in Minnesota. What would happen if you went to this model, you know, and you just had to kind of put in and compete on a competitive basis, didn't have kind of reliable source of funding, whether it's from RDF or some other source, you know, of this amount? What would happen to IRE if it didn't have kind of a, you know, a stable source of revenue on which to rely?
Mr. Hemmingson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I think it's unclear to me what would happen to IRE, the organization. One of the advantages we've had with having these funds in hands is really not only the numbers with respect to the size of the research community that I mentioned, but the level and degree of communication amongst and between research teams. And my colleague Rod Larkins and I are fortunate to sit where we sit, and countless times we've been able to assist one group of faculty by partnering them up with other faculty somewhere else in the university. So the coordination, the continuity would be, I think, significantly different if they were just a series of sort of one-off, perhaps less connected sets of research proposals. And one of the other differences, certainly regardless of whether we apply here or run our own process, is the focus solely on renewable electricity would pretty substantially change what has at least been the contribution of the university to develop renewable energy technologies.
You know, members, we have a situation where we have a few more testifiers, but we also have some time next Tuesday. Apparently we've got some issues with one of the bills, so we won't be hearing that on Tuesday. Would you like to continue on with Mr. Hinkle, or would you rather bring it up on Tuesday?
Madam Chair, I have a Chamber of Commerce meeting at 5 o'clock.
Well, we better. Would that be okay with everybody to continue? Because I think we may have more questions for you, too, on Tuesday. I think the conversation is not over. It may give everybody a chance to look at the language a little bit more and have some comments.
Well, Madam Chair and members, thank you again for the opportunity today, and we certainly look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. And if I'd known that, I probably would have let you keep going. Mr. Hemmingson said so. But with that, thanks again, and the meeting is adjourned.